Support for NPR podcasts comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. I don't want to be coy, said Barack Obama last Sunday, asked about a run for the White House. I have thought about the possibility. And with those six words, the lid blew off the run of Obama mania that has been building ever since a bright-eyed Barack Obama wowed the nation at the Democratic National Convention 2 years ago. The now senator from Illinois, the kid from Kansas and Kenya, has served less than 2 years in Washington. But the drumbeat for an Obama presidential bid is absolutely booming. Is he too young? Is he the right stuff? We'll ask him. Up next on Point, a conversation with Senator Barack Obama on hope, the country, and the presidency. Joining me now from Pasadena, California, is Barack Obama, powerful new force in the Democratic Party and American politics. He is 45, the junior U.S. Senator from Illinois, and right now as hot as a young politician in the wings can get. He has a compelling personal story. His mother, a Kansas girl, his father from Kenya. He grew up in Hawaii, went to Columbia University and Harvard Law School, was the first black editor of the Harvard Law Review. Whatever you think, he's got heart and he's not afraid to show it. His new book is The Audacity of Hope, Thoughts on Reclaiming the American Dream. Barack Obama, welcome, and welcome to On Point.
Thank you so much, Tom.
What a week. Did you have any idea you were going to set this off when you sat down with Tim Russert and said, I'm going to think about it?
Well, you know, I got to say that I called my wife, and her only comment the day after was, look what you did. Like I'd made a mess on the floor or something.
If that's a mess, that's a doozy. What do you make of this kind of blow-the-lid-off enthusiasm that has come to greet those few words on a Sunday talk show?
Well, look, I think that we live in a celebrity culture, and things get overhyped pretty quick. And to some degree, I'm riding the wave of sort of flavor of the month hyperbole. But I do think, or at least I hope, that some of it has to do with me tapping into a mood that's in the country right now generally. And I just happen to be sort of representative of it right now. And that is a sense that our politics currently are inadequate to the challenges that we face, and that our politics don't reflect the core decency of the American people. And I think there's a hunger for a new way of talking about our democracy and who we are as a nation. And to some degree, I think I'm just benefiting from this larger mood that people are in.
Do you call yourself, do you think of yourself as a man, a politician of the center, Barack Obama?
Well, probably not in the way that our current categories describe it. You know, I think that part of what I've tried to do, at least, is to say that many of the old frameworks we're using don't work. Conservative, liberal, don't describe whether or not we're actually solving problems. Within the Democratic Party, there's a centrist poll and a old-time religion liberal poll. And I'm not sure that is very useful for the Democratic Party either. The way I think about it is that there are a set of core values that are important to me that I consider progressive. For example, I think that in a nation that spends as much money as we do on health care, that we can afford and, in fact, would benefit from universal health care. But I'm agnostic in terms of how we achieve it, you know, whether it's a single-payer plan versus a market-based plan. What I want to do is experiment and figure out what's the way that we can get the most bang for the buck. And so in that sense, you know, I would be considered left or progressive in terms of my goals. But in terms of how we achieve those things, I'm much more interested in being practical and figuring out what we can get done.
Very polarized country, we're told and have been told for a while. Is it too late for a politician like you? You write in the book, The Audacity of Hope, you write, politics, like science, depends on our ability to persuade each other of common aims based on a common reality. Do Americans still have that?
I really think they do. One of the things I write about in the book is, I spend a lot of time traveling across the country now, but even in Illinois, when I was first running for the U.S. Senate, Illinois is an interesting microcosm of the country because it's black, white, Hispanic, Asian. It's north, south, east, west, urban, rural. And what always struck me as I was traveling around the state was the degree to which there are a set of common values and ideals that Americans share. The country is not as polarized as our politics would suggest. And so the question then becomes, is there a way of capturing the complexity and ambiguity and all sorts of interesting nuances and cross-pollinations that are taking place in people's everyday lives? Can we capture that in our politics? And so that's really the challenge. It's not so much that the country is divided as the language we use and the way we've organized our politics emphasizes our divisions rather than what we hold in common.
Do you think the party structure in the Democratic Party is going to embrace something like that? I mean, you've got a huge wave of enthusiasm right now, political delirium, one columnist wrote this week. David Brooks says this is a case where the mega hype is matched by the man. But if you're really looking for something in the center, even though you call yourself a progressive, will the Democratic Party come with you?
Well, I don't know. I think I'm part of a broader conversation. I don't think I'm unique in this process. If you look at some of the Democrats who are starting to come on the national scene, somebody like an Elliot Spitzer in New York, or Governor Schweitzer in Montana, seemingly diverse characters, and yet both of them are a little harder to categorize than I think our traditional politics. If you look at among African-American candidates, you've got people who would be considered classically liberal, like Deval Patrick in Massachusetts, people who would be considered conservative, like Harold Ford in Tennessee. But both of them, I think, try to avoid being put in a box. And so I actually think that this is going to be the trend within the Democratic Party, and I think it'll be the trend more broadly. I suspect that both parties are going to have to deal with this. There's a reason why you're seeing more and more voters identify themselves as independent. It doesn't necessarily mean that they're centrist in the sense that they just want to split the difference on every issue. What it does mean is that, that they're more interested in looking at issues in a practical, non-ideological way. I think the American people are profoundly non-ideological.
Kind of delirium of speculation about 08 and you in this week, but at the same time, an awful lot of attention on the 06 midterms right in front of us. How are you reading those, Barack Obama? What do you see coming? What do you expect the message is going to be from the polls?
You know, I think that the country is in a serious mood, and that's part of the reason why the traditional playbook that we've seen over the last several election cycles of, stoking up fears and keying in on divisive social issues is not really working. People are looking at healthcare or education or energy and certainly Iraq and saying, why can't we make some progress on these issues? And how are you going to solve problems? And they're much less interested in the parties calling the other side names. And that, I think, bodes well for Democrats because I think when the country is paying attention and their polls suggesting that the country is paying much more attention to more issues this time out than they have over the last several election cycles, I think that Democrats will benefit from that. And as a consequence, my suspicion is that come November 8th, the Democrats will have at least retaken one chamber of Congress, and there's going to be a strong push, I think, to move away from the sharply ideological absolutist approach that we've seen out of the Congress over the last several years.
And you know, right on the other side of that day, the cameras are going to light up for the presidential election. Here you are with the book tour and the talk about running right in the middle of that. What are you saying now? You got everybody's attention, heads snapped all over. I thought about it. You said this week, when are you going to say what, Barack Obama, about whether or not you're running for the White House?
Well, keep in mind, not to sound coy or shy about this, but I responded to Tim Russert simply because I'd been getting the question every stop that I was making during the book tour or during campaign appearances on behalf of other candidates. And the Time magazine article had already come out.
The next title, president on the cover
right,
with your exactly. smiling
yeah,
face.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, the title was not one I selected. And so, you know, Russert asked me a question, and I responded as honestly as I could, which is to say I would probably be lying if I said that I hadn't thought of it. But what I said very clearly was that I hadn't had the time to think about any run for higher office with the seriousness and depth that I think is required in order to actually make a race. And that was sort of the end of the conversation, and folks have just been going from there.
Senator Obama, a lot of people want to speak with you. I'd like to bring them in, if I may. John's calling from Spring Hill, Tennessee. John, you're on the air with Barack Obama.
Good day, Tom. Good day, Mr. Obama.
Hi, John.
I have a question, and with almost 60% of the American public seemingly disapproves of politicians of either party. I know that we don't live in a time of Mr. Smith goes to Washington, but is it possible for a candidate to actually just speak his heart and talk about what he believes morally and not be co-opted by campaign managers, polls, the media? Are we past that point, or is it something that you can do? I was so disappointed in the way Mr. Kerry responded to the Swift Boat people, and even the way Mr. McCain responded to George Bush calling him, questioning his patriotism in front of the VFW. So could you answer that question? Are we at a point? Are we past that point?
Were candor's possible, Senator Obama?
You know, candor's worked for me so far, but I think that it's important, and I write about this in the book, that I won my Senate race in some pretty unusual circumstances. You know, some people have called me the luckiest politician in America, and you know, I ran.
You had a Republican opponent, kind of had to drop out in disgrace on the way to the polls.
Well, exactly, and you know, I ran in a 7-way primary where I had a guy who had $400 million, spent $30 million on the race, but for whatever reason, he decided not to run any negative ads, and so there was a positive campaign throughout the primary. I never had to run any negative ads, and I didn't. That's something that I've never done. I win the primary, and then in the Republican general election, as you said, my Republican candidate drops out because of some personal scandals or issues. Mm-hmm. And and then I had a month where I had no opponent at all, and I could just talk about my vision for the country. Mm-hmm. Then I give a keynote address at the Democratic convention, have, you know, 17, 18 minutes of unadulterated airtime with the American people, and then the Republican Party, for some reason, decides to assign Alan Keyes, who doesn't live in Illinois, he's from Maryland, as my opponent. So the way things worked for me was not typical, and it's an enormous luxury for me to be able to enter into the public national spotlight without having gone through some of the typical nastiness of campaigning. And you know, when you look at what's happening nationally, I think it's very difficult to avoid that muck. So far, I've been able to do it, but you know, I don't want to pretend that somehow this all has to do with my attributes. Some of it has to do with circumstances. The one thing I will say about the capacity for candor in our politics, a lot of it depends on our citizens. You know, that wonderful saying, Justice Louis Brandeis once said that the most important office in a democracy is the office of citizen. And if the American people are paying attention and they're willing to hear not just good news or attacks on other people, but are willing to hear sort of complex arguments around some of the difficult issues that we face, and they reward candidates for doing that, then I think you see more candidates doing it. The problem is that sometimes the public doesn't want to hear, you know, some of the tougher choices that we have, and that's when the pollsters and the consultants, et cetera, start, you know, being able to exert more influence over the process.
I hear you saying in that answer to John in Tennessee that maybe you don't know if candor will work in 2006 or 2008.
You know, I think that we are in a process of of experimentation. I think there's a great hunger for that kind of politics. And the question is you know, not to frame this in sort of grandiose terms, but the question of whether the better angels of our nature, when it comes to our political system, can overcome the darker impulses in our politics I think the jury is still out, and I believe that we can. But as many people have noted, in some ways, you know, I have not been tested in that fashion and on the national stage, and so you know, I'll be testing it out over the next several years, and we'll report back to you in terms of whether my head is bloodied but unbowed.
The better angels of our nature, to quote another Illinois politician, one named Abe. Let me get a call from Iowa City, Iowa. Lauren is on the line. Hi, Lauren. You're on the air with Barack Obama.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Barack. Thanks for having me talk. Listen, I just have a concern, you know, with Barack being perhaps a presidential hopeful, or perhaps just maybe even just the new face of the Democratic Party in America. I think we hear so much on the media about what he has to say and about these great speeches that he gives, and you do, Barack, absolutely. But I think that one of the major downturns for the Democratic Party is the lack of action. And I haven't heard anything about what you've been doing as a legislator. And I think before ever even thinking about presidency or even being the face of the Democratic Party, like, we need to hear what you're doing and not just what you're saying.
Well, I think it's great that you asked me. So and it's true. Oftentimes in interviews, people don't really focus on my legislative record and my proposals. I've served in the state legislature for 7 years, and for the first 6 years, I was in the minority party. Mm-hmm. And so I was able to get a bunch of stuff done, but it was only in concert with the Republican majority. So I passed the first campaign ethics reform legislation in 25 years in Illinois and helped to structure our welfare reform program so that not only did people start moving off welfare, but they also had some support in terms of daycare and transportation assistance. Helped to reform the juvenile justice system. It wasn't really until I was in the majority, which was only my last 2 years in the state legislature, that I think the first year that I was in office, I in the majority, I passed 25 pieces of legislation, including reforming the death penalty there, requiring the first in the nation videotaping of interrogations and confessions in capital cases, because we had a pretty scandalous record of people wrongly on death row, expanding child care or health care to children across Illinois, making sure that we had a series of open government measures that improved transparency and accountability. And so those are the things that I did at the state level. Now, I find myself repeating that pattern now that I'm in
Republican Washington.
Because you know, over the last 2 years, I've been in the minority. So the things that I'm proudest of are areas where I've had to work in a bipartisan fashion and finding opportunities to make a difference. So I was probably the first legislator to advance a serious proposal in terms of dealing with the avian flu and pandemic. Worked with Dick Lugar, the Republican a senior senator from Indiana, on the next phase of non-proliferation issues and making sure that not only are we dealing with nuclear weapons, but also things like shouldered air missiles, spending a lot of time on veterans issues because we've got huge numbers of veterans that are coming back. And then I've got a series of proposals, many of which are still in committee, expanding health care to more Americans, making sure that we're providing things like electronic billing to medical providers so that we're cutting down costs, reforming our education system one district at a time. Right now we're doing it a school at a time, but it's not as expansive. And probably the thing that I'm most proud of this term, because we actually got a bill passed and signed, was working with an unlikely partner, Tom Coburn, very conservative Republican from Oklahoma, but a very sincere guy. Worked to pass the first fully searchable internet database on federal spending so that we can start reducing some of the the earmarks and pork projects that not only have a corrupting influence on Washington, but are also diverting resources that could be going into things like providing health care for kids. So, but I think that the general point that was made is entirely legitimate, which is hopefully over time people start asking me more about ideas and issues and platforms and so forth than simply the fact that I'm getting my name in the newspapers.
I'm sure they will, and I'm sure we will. But let me just ask you, on the face of it, there you give us a quick tour of what remains at this point a very short Washington political career, not even 2 years yet.
Right?
Are you, when the presidential conversation comes up, are you too inexperienced? Are you too young? JFK 43 when he was sworn in, Bill Clinton 46, but they'd had more time in office. How do you look at the question of youth and experience when it comes to yourself, Barack Obama, and perhaps the White House?
Well, these are all issues that at the point where I'm considering, I think I've got to make an assessment of that. And then ultimately the American people make these assessments in terms of how experienced you are. It's interesting. One of the areas that's come up most frequently has been on the issue of foreign policy, which I think is interesting because, I'm probably one of the few senators who actually has lived overseas, who has family overseas.
Actually spent some time growing up in Indonesia, Islamic country.
Exactly. Majored in international relations in college. Am serving on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And in 2002, in the run-up to the Iraq War, said in a public speech in Chicago that this is a bad idea, this is going to cost us billions of dollars and thousands of lives, and we're not going to be able to get out of there once we're there, and I don't see any clear evidence of weapons of mass destruction. And so I, one of the things that I'm always amused by is when people question, potential foreign policy credentials, I say, the experience in Washington may not be something that is particularly useful in terms of making policy.
Well, what about that? Dick Durbin, your fellow senator from Illinois, is on the record saying, don't wait, Barack Obama. Do you think, 6 or 8 or whatever more years in the U.S. Senate is really going to make you better off politically? Someone says you'll end up a windbag like Senator Joe Biden. Not your words or his, I know, but does more time help or not?
Well, look, I think more time gives you more experience and hopefully more wisdom. Sometimes it makes you more fearful and more hesitant, and it leads you to fudge and shade what you believe in. And so I think it depends on how that time is used.
Let me take a call from Orlando, Florida. Steve's calling. Steve, you're on the air with Barack Obama.
Hello. How are you?
Very well.
I'm great.
Great. Let's see. I'm a youth minister with the UCC. I know that's Barack's denomination as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Had a wonderful article in the UCC paper recently, by the way. I'm checking to see how does your belief, the UCC tends to lean a little to the left of where our president is.
You're talking United Church of Christ here.
Yes, right. I am. And I'm seeing our president has been fairly vocal about how his faith guides him. I'm wondering the same of Mr. Obama.
Well, it's a great question. I have a chapter in the book devoted to the issue of faith, and I'm not somebody who was raised in a strong religious tradition. I always used to joke with my mom that she was the last of the great liberal secular humanists, so we would go to church once in a while, and then we would go to the Buddhist temple, and then we would go to the synagogue, and all of it was part of this wonderful experience humanity trying to explain the mysteries of life. But she looked at it very much through the lens of the anthropologist that she was. It wasn't until I went to Chicago as a community organizer and was in the far south side of Chicago, a community that had been devastated by steel plant closings, and people were out of work, and crime was on the rise, and so forth. So I was working with churches in the area to try to mobilize around job training programs and other strategies. And I started to really connect with not just the church generally, but the particular experience of the historically black church. I had always been inspired by the civil rights movement and Dr. King and what had happened, and to become a part of that, I think, was central to my own development and growing into manhood. So today, the way I think about faith, and this is what I write about in the book, is that I think those of us who consider ourselves progressive make a mistake when we are entirely suspicious of religious practice. I think the expectation that somehow religion should be left at the door when you enter into conversations about public policy is wrong. If you think about the great social movements in our history from abolition on forward, they have often been motivated, if not generally been motivated, by strong religious values and belief. But I think that it has to be tempered, one, with a clear respect for the separation of church and state, which doesn't just protect the state from theocracy, but also the church from encroachment, which is why the original biggest advocates, other than Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, for separation of church and state, were actually the forefathers of the evangelical movement. You know, they were the Baptists who were out in the fields singing songs and with a lot of radical interpretations of religion that and didn't want to be encroached upon by the Congregationalists and the established churches. And the second thing that I talk about in the book is I think the importance of those of us who may be in part motivated by religious belief have to be able to translate those beliefs into universal ideas that can be discussed, that are amenable to argument and reason. I think where we get into trouble is the notion that I think that we should do X because God tells me so, or because it's in my religious book. I think at that point, it's hard for a pluralistic democracy to function if people are taking that notion, which may be very appropriate in terms of our personal private faith, and trying to apply that to our public discourse. Mm.
Olivia is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Olivia, you're on the air with Barack Obama.
Oh, hi. Hi, Mr. Ashbrook. Hi, Senator Obama. My question is this. As a young person, this will be my first midterm election, my first election ever. I'm concerned that there's so much polarity in the country, that there's such a divide between Republican and Democrats and conservative and liberal. And I remember seeing an article a couple years back where Time or Newsweek called you the front of, like, the purple movement trying to bring people together. And I'm really inspired by your message of hope. But what would your plan or suggestion be to try to bring people together in light of Iraq and everybody being so angry and argumentative about all these issues? How would you suggest we go about fixing the country and bringing people together in a more unified America?
Well, I think a good place to start, Olivia, is you being involved. One of the things that I've always believed is that when the public is paying attention, we get better politics. And when the public is not paying attention, what happens is that party professionals are looking simply to turn out their base and demoralize the other side. And elections get very close, they end up turning around very polarizing issues. And so I think the idea that people are paying attention, asking hard questions about what we're going to do around important issues, I think makes all the difference. Now, part of the reason I think that the country is in a serious mood right now is when you look at the challenges we face, there's certain challenges that we've got to deal with now. If we don't deal with them now, they're going to get worse, and in some cases, we may not be able to really deal with them seriously. I already mentioned healthcare. The fact that we spend more money on healthcare than any nation on earth, but have some of the worst outcomes of any industrialized nation, which is burdening not only families with rising costs if they've got health insurance. 46 million don't have health insurance, but it's also straining businesses and making us less competitive. We know that our economy has to respond to globalization in a way that not only is competitive but also spreads the burdens and benefits of a globalized economy more fairly. I was reading the newspaper that earlier today and seeing that corporate profits are once again up in record numbers. You've got huge gains in productivity as a consequence of globalization and technology and efficiency, but wages and salaries have flatlined. That polarizes the country because you're seeing much more inequality in income distribution. And so the question is, how are we making sure that everybody is getting the kind of education they need and training they need, and what kinds of policies are in place in order to make sure that everybody's got a shot at opportunity?
And what about Iraq? Olivia raises Iraq. Everybody wants to know what to do there. How do you look at that deep puzzle, deep challenge right now?
Well, I think part of the reason that you're seeing so much anguish is that we now have no good options. We've got bad options and worse options. And I think that the way to think constructively about it is to look at the facts squarely and stop engaging in either denial or in relitigation of past decisions. As I said, I thought that the decision to go in there was a bad idea. I think it was a failure not simply of execution but conception. Having said that, now we're all in it together trying to figure out what the best thing to do is. And it is my strong belief that we need to begin a phased withdrawal that sends a signal to the Iraqis that there are no military solutions to this problem. There are only political solutions.
You've talked about doing that by the end of this year, beginning that withdrawal. Are we past that point now?
At this point, I think it's probably unrealistic to expect that it would happen by the end of this year because we're so close to the end of the year. But what I would hope is after the election, and this may be helped by the James Baker, Lee Hamilton Commission that Congress initiated, and I think it may be helped by the fact that the Republicans will have suffered some significant political losses and are going to be looking for some place to land in terms of policy. My hope is we can get together with military and intelligence experts and make some determinations. How do we, number one, begin that phased withdrawal? Number two, initiate serious conversations with the Iraqis around how they can stabilize during this transition? Number three, how can we get some of the regional powers in place, including Iran and Syria, to start playing a constructive role? And the incentive for countries like Iran and Syria, by the way, are right now they have the luxury of sitting back and watching us flounder about in Iraq. But if we have sent a clear signal we are going to start a phased redeployment, then they now have to consider the possibility that Iraq completely implodes and they've got a million Iraqis streaming over their borders, something that they can't afford. Right.
Senator Obama, I've read the headline, phased withdrawal, and even by the end of this year, but I've also heard you talk, I believe, about the U.S. being there for a long time, a sort of a long commitment in Iraq. How would you see the longer-term engagement with Iraq?
Well, I don't think that we can have permanent bases there, and I don't think that we should have significant troop presence there. I think the idea that we would function in Iraq the way, let's say, we have in the Korean Peninsula and just maintain troop levels in the middle of the Middle East over the next 50 years, I think would be an enormous mistake. So what I've said is that let's say we begin a phased withdrawal. We probably don't want to pull out all our troops immediately. What we want to do is to try to figure out, and this is in conjunction with the military and in reference to making sure that we're minimizing as much as possible the risks of even worse civil war than we have now, as well as U.S. casualties, that we may leave some troops in areas that can be quickly deployed in emergency situations, that can provide logistical support, can continue to provide training to the armed forces and security forces in Iraq. But what we can't do is be in the middle of Baghdad trying to effectively keep the lid on battles between militias and ethnic strife.
Is this cut and run? Does it leave Iraq to melt down, the region to melt down?
Well, I think that there are risks in every decision that we're going to make. And one of the reasons that I have always been hesitant, despite my strong opposition to the war, of a precipitous pullout was we have some responsibilities there, having removed Saddam Hussein, but also effectively eliminated any military or police presence in Iraq. It is incumbent upon us to try to function responsibly as possible, even as we exit. But I'm less concerned about labels like cut and run and more concerned about simply getting it right. The administration has put us in a very difficult situation at this point, and all of us, I think, are going to have to make some tough, cold-eyed assessments of what is the best possible outcome, although we're always going to be working on the basis of probabilities.
Let me take a call from Mizrak in Dorchester, Massachusetts. Hi, Mizrak, you're on the air.
Okay. If elected or if you decide to be one, how would you change the U.S. Vision overseas? Right now, it's very poor. Mm-hmm. Used to be the New World, United States. You know, everybody was looking after the United States. Now it has changed. So what I mean is, how would you change the policy, or how would you deal with the image of United States abroad?
Mizrak, I hear a little accent in your voice. Where are you from?
Ethiopia.
Ethiopia. Question from an Ethiopian in Dorchester. Barack Obama, what about the American image abroad?
Well, I think it's a great question. One of the things that I think both Democrats and Republicans and independents would agree to is that our standing overseas has drastically diminished over the last several years, certainly since 9/11, when you'll recall the whole world was rallying around us, and you had headlines in Le Monde saying, yeah, we are all Americans.
Mm-hmm.
That goodwill has been lost. Now, I am not as pessimistic as some, believing that, if we make alterations in policy, and also a change in tone, that we can actually recover some of that goodwill. The tone issue is important simply because we've had an administration that has gone out of its way to indicate that it doesn't really care what the world thinks and is dismissive of any restraint on the part of the United States when it comes to military action, when it comes to the UN, when it comes to working effectively with our allies. And in that sense, tone matters. But not only do we need a change in tone, obviously we're also going to need some changes in policy. One of the areas where I think we can make the most progress is in really trying to strengthen our international institutions and beginning to recognize that it's in our self-interest more than anybody to have a well-functioning United Nations, for example. Now, I am as impatient as others oftentimes with some of the mischief that's done at the United Nations. I think that the General Assembly can be full of hot air and not be particularly productive. There are many agencies that are non-functioning. But rather than simply run down the UN, we need to try to strengthen those agencies because to the extent that we can help be part of a international set of institutions that are stabilizing ungoverned areas, dealing with public health issues that may lead to pandemic, assisting in terms of encouraging literacy around the world, resolving conflicts before they explode and we end up with huge numbers of refugees. All those things contribute to our national security, and we need to return to a recognition that we saw in the Greatest Generation after World War II, where you had people like Truman and Acheson and Marshall and Keenan, all of whom came together and recognized that if we are building a strong NATO, if we're investing in the Marshall Plan, if we're encouraging a United Nations, that setting up a set of international rules of the road that people can follow and that we abide by will actually enhance our power and our long-term security.
Barack Obama, let me turn home with you for a moment, if I may. Frank Rich, the New York Times, has a line. He describes you as people sometimes seeing you as a one-man Benetton ad. I want to look at this issue of race with you. Shelby Steele, conservative essayist, writes about the psychology of race. He says, white people are just thrilled when a prominent black person comes along and doesn't rub their noses in racial guilt. White people just go crazy over people like that. I want to ask you, first of all, how you understand your own racial identity, and then how it intersects with American politics these days. In the book, you describe yourself as, an interesting phrasing, a black man of mixed heritage. So how do you see your racial identity and how it hits American politics?
Well, you know, I wrote a first book called Dreams from My Father that, mm-hmm. that was really sort of a personal journey and sort of an examination of my process of self-discovery as a young man who grew up with an African father who I didn't know, and a white mother who was really the constant in my life and a guiding source of my values, but also spent time in Hawaii and Indonesia. So, you know, to some extent, I'm a polyglot.
Are you an African American?
I certainly am an African American, although obviously I come to that hyphenated identity differently than many African Americans. But you know, my life is steeped in America's black culture. Yeah, I live on the south side of Chicago and married to an African-American woman who grew up in Chicago, and that's how we're raising our children. And that's how I'm.
Is that identity a plus or minus in 2006, 2007, 2008 in American politics today?
Well, I don't know how it plays politically. I talk about the chapter in a chapter on race in The Audacity of Hope. I talk about the fact that when I was born in 1961, obviously race relations were very different than they are now. And I think we've made enormous strides over the last 45 years. You know, the problem isn't not that we haven't made progress. The problem is that, you know, better isn't good enough. We still have a lot of work to do. Where I think that we can be encouraged is the fact that although prejudice still exists, I believe that people and people still make snap judgments and stereotypes about individuals. If they have a chance to get to know the other person, they can get beyond those prejudices and stereotypes in a way that wasn't possible even a generation ago. And that, I think, is a significant change. Now, the area where I think that we have to make the most progress, and this really tests our race relations in ways that you know are more difficult to us, is how do we invest in, for example, inner city communities that are still suffering the legacy and history of slavery and Jim Crow.
So there's the on-the-ground piece. Senator, our time is very short. Another question for you. Colin Powell teased back in the 90s when he had a big book out, sold a lot of copies, but never ran for president. Are you serious in your contemplation of it? Would you do it if it meant going head-to-head, let's say, with Hillary Clinton in the Democratic primaries?
Well, all these questions are a little bit premature, but you don't go into this without being serious. Again, to some extent, I'm responding to what people have asked me about, and it'd be pretty difficult. I'd be probably the best politician on earth if I was able to have engineered what's going on right now.
Charlie Rose asked if you really had any choice, or in effect he asked, is this destiny? Do you feel that you may not have a choice, that it's just in the cards?
Well, you know what? I'm a strong believer that you choose your own destiny. So I'm going to be deadly serious about considering what my options are after the 06 election. I want to make sure all the listeners are focused on an election in 11 days and the fact that we've got one of the most important midterms elections coming up.
Senator Barack Obama of Illinois, author of the new book, The Audacity of Hope, Thoughts on Reclaiming the American Dream. Barack Obama, thanks very much for being with us today.
Tom, it was a great pleasure. Thank you so much, and to all the folks who called in.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new MDX with available real-time traffic monitoring. More information at Acura.com.